Long Coast City Council Workshop. It is Tuesday, January 28, 2020. It is 9 a.m. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Mayor Holland.
Here.
Vice Mayor Kucis.
Present.
Councilmember Brandolino.
Right here.
Councilmember Kopp.
Present.
Councilmember Howell.
Here.
Mayor, all members are present.
Wonderful. Now open up to public participation. Any member of the public wish to make public comments? You have up to 3 minutes. Please go.
Hi, good morning. My name is Leanne Huggins. I'm here to speak to an item not on the agenda, the potential rezoning of the Matanzas Woods Golf Course. For the last 6 weeks, myself and a large group of citizens have been going door-to-door in the L section to gain signatures for a petition for the course to remain greenbelt. Getting out and meeting our neighbors throughout the L section has been a rewarding and emotional experience. We love being able to share with our neighbors our mutual feelings about the potential loss of our peaceful backyard, loss of additional equity in our homes, once when the course closed, and now again with the influx of 6,000 square foot lots. We've shared the sorrow we all feel about our beloved deer not visiting us, the concerns we have about the real possibility of the gopher tortoises not being rehomed or the wood storks losing their nests. Of the hundreds of doors we've knocked upon, not once have we met someone who's in agreement with what's being proposed. Many have said they vow to vote out the council members who do not protect our investments, our qualities of life, and most importantly, our health. We've met people who have placed bird sanctuaries on the course, started gardens, buried their beloved pets there as well. One particular lady sobbed at the thought of her beloved dog being excavated. It's truly amazing what this land behind our homes has come to mean to us. It's clear that the city is allowing us to be impacted in a monstrous way with the proposed change. It's life-changing. So many said they'll have to move with commercial proposed behind their homes. Others have already consulted with realtors upon listings. Many were angry at the fines the city collected while we sat in blight, and even more astounded when the city did not purchase the land with those fines to protect the residents from further destruction. We met a couple who purchased a home in 2018 from Zillow Pictures because they lived 2,000 miles away. The Zillow ad stated golf course views and showed manicured greens that a neighbor had been keeping cut. They were told the course is closed for renovation. We've talked to people who just built their homes this year and were charged additional costs by builders to have architectural scrolling on the back of their home because they were technically on a course and it was required per code. The stories go on and on, and what is certain was the stress they're under. They can't imagine years of dump trucks up and down the only corridor we have for getting in and out of our neighborhood. Some shudder at the thought of contaminated soil pouring out of those trucks as we follow behind them. We'll be out again this weekend getting signatures, even though city planning department employees have told us they aren't worth much in their opinion. It may take each of us an hour per door because so many of them want to tell us what they paid, what they were promised when they bought into this section, and what they'll miss most when this developer takes it away. But it's okay, it takes an hour a door. We're more than happy to be there for our neighbors, unlike this city. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker. Phyllis Robin Scheffler, you are the governing body of our city. Without your okay, things remain status quo. If you won't show the interest to correct a wrong, there's no incentive to the city manager, Matthew Morton, or the chief development officer, Jason DiLorenzo, or even the attorney, William Reichman, to work toward a change in an ill-designed permit application. Hence, all the wrongs perpetrated by designing contractors to outsmart the permitting department remain intact. At every three-minute occasion that I'm given the opportunity to speak for Florida Statute 286.0114, I reiterate the problem extant, and yet you, as a body, do not move to correct a blatant problem. Will you wait until there are more Phyllis Robin Schefflers to report being sinfully harmed by untruthful contractors before you act? Do I need to amass a cadre of like-minded souls to get you to react? Once all of the Florida Park residents rose up to the traffic problem, you embarked on a solution. You are aiding and abetting the unscrupulous trio of Don Guyaney, and Cindy and John Costa, and I am left to flounder in a cesspool of deceit. I'm going to summarize how the actions of the aforementioned trio, one of whom, Don Guyany, cannot be located by the state inspector, Kenneth Boris. These three defrauded the city by blatantly falsifying the permit application. Number one, the city council has not accepted the responsibility to protect me from a dishonest contractor. Two, the city's permitting department has allowed John Costa to continue to build under the license of Don Guyany. Three, the city's permitting department has ignored the illegality of notary Cindy Costa from validating the dubious signature of Don Guyany per state statute 117.05. Four, the city's permitting department provided only two inspections for a restoration project that spanned 6 weeks. Five, the first of two inspectors did not demand the permit be on site. So I ask, why is the city council loath to address the issue?
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Guy Carl, I had just one question to ask. When it came to the moratorium on the small box stores like Dollar, I want to know just where you got your information that the people resented having these stores built. I've asked and I've been quiet. Quite a few people. Half of them didn't care one way or the other if you had a dollar store or not. And the other half were happy that they had dollar stores because it saves them travel and it saves them money and time. So I ask you again, where did you get all this information that people don't want dollar stores? Or is this something of your own imagination? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Good morning. I'm Silvan Mejia for letting me speak. I'm respectfully going to bring some issues that have to do right now with the carnage taking in our roads, with speeders, that we are all, we know about, we lose children's lives, it's very important to us. And my experience, some of those, to me, some of those accidents are given to speed, and the speed is related to the driver, or also not having the city, some items on our roads which are considered safety for the residential roads. We have narrow, curvy residential roads that don't even have enough room for two opposed cars pass by without hitting mailboxes. One of them, the streets on the Woodlands where this tragedy happened, and the streets like Cooper Lane and Casper Lane, and also Florida Parkway. So I just spent in Arizona by my daughter in the state of Arizona, the county of Maricopa and their cities. They installed all around schools at the entrance of residential areas, within residential areas, and by official buildings, they installed these, what I call, soft humps. My daughter has an Equinox, 3 years old. He's been driving those since she has the car and before, and it causes no damage to the cars. And the cars have to also prevent damage. They always, everybody goes slow, and everybody is safe. I brought a picture here that I will be glad to give to the mayor at my own cost, so the mayor can see this. The statue for the humps over there in Arizona by the county of Maricopa and the city of Chandler, where my daughter lives, I live, are much more positive than the statues or comments that I see in the state of Florida regarding the state and humps. So this will save lives. If these humps will make us go a little bit, spend three more minutes in our tree. If it saves one life, it is worth. Now, Also, streets like Cooper Lane, I drive always 15, 20 the most. The other day, I saw a sign, 30 miles an hour, this street. I put my car at 30 miles an hour in Cooper Lane, and I was scared to death with the people who I had to slow down to 15 miles an hour. Who decides, Ms. Mayor, to put these speed limits in these narrow roads? Casper, Cooper, and also there is one 30-mile speed limit sign on one block of Franklin by the school parking lot, a 30 miles an hour sign on one block only street, Franklin Road of Florida Park Drive. This is all I have to say, and I wear my green today because I also have a thought like the first speaker, and I put this is for hope for our mayor and council to do right for us. Thank you so very much.
Steve Carr, Palm Coast. Florida Park Drive, according to the FDOT website, has more traffic than all the non-residential streets around it.
Whoa.
Wow, that's pretty steep. So I try to understand why the city of Palm Coast does not have a traffic common program within the city to help discourage cut through traffic. And it's just amazing that we don't. But I have to say, the Sheriff's Department has been responsive to our calls to them about the speeding problem on Florida Park Drive. They have been out there, I have seen them, and I have to say that it's very welcome. The problem is, once we stop calling and once we stop reporting it, the speeders are back and we gotta go back through it again and again and again. And it really doesn't make a lot of sense to tie up the Sheriff's Department that way. They need to be out fighting crime, not chasing all these people that are speeding through the residential area. So I beg for the city to look at a program for traffic common within the residential neighborhoods that will help slow down the traffic, that will help deter people from using it as a thoroughfare. Thank you.
Next speaker.
Hi, I'm Deborah Vitale. I've lived in Palm Coast for 2 years. I'm from Virginia. Actually, originally from Florida, graduated from the University of Florida, got my registered, my RN, my BSN in nursing. Lived in Virginia 30 years and did a lot of triage in ICU and CCU. I worked at a level one trauma center, so I know when people start getting sick, just what happens to our medical health facilities. They get overwhelmed. So the reports right now out of China are alarming. I don't know if anyone's paying attention to fatality rates. The CDC has been giving conferences every day. I've been listening to them. And I just want to say that I think the first thing, and I know you might defer this to the public health department, but we need face masks. And if we don't have an ample supply of face masks, because those are the first things that are going to fly off the shelves, okay? People want to protect their families. They need to go to work. They need to go to gas stations, pump their cars with gas. They're going to be wearing face masks. If this becomes a pandemic, we are really going to be at a loss. And I would suggest just making sure that we have ample supplies for the citizens in Flagler County and, you know, Palm Coast. That's all I have to say. Thank you. Next speaker.
Good morning, Perry Matrano, 207 London Drive. I'd like to speak about the quality of life in the area that's going to change and be impacted by the potential Matanzas Wood golf course change. The area had a beautiful golf course at one time. We moved there 15 years ago. We're very proud to be a part of this city. I think I know almost every member of the council, and you all know me as a pretty straightforward person. What I would like to just point out to you is something that staff can't ever do for you is to bring you information that changes by the moment. You know, staff is very good, there are wonderful people there. As a former director with the city of Bunnell, I can tell you that the information we get is from the people that supply us that information, a lot of times contractors or whatever. Sometimes things are not presented as planned, and that information gets rolled up to you, and you have to make these decisions that will impact everyone in that community. And in our case, the quality of life is going to change quickly. There's going to be a large number of smaller homes put in, smaller lots put in. That's what the plan is, I guess. And at the end of the day, we have a beautiful, original ITT, and Councilman Cuff knows about that very well. The style of the homes that we have today is one that I have. I'm very proud of my home. I love where we live. I don't live on a golf course. I can see the golf course from my house. What's nice about that whole thing is that it's a beautiful naturescape, a nature preserve, and it looks just absolutely stunning. But I know it's going to change. And there's lots of platted lots that were in the golf course community at one time. I don't understand how a person can make a $650,000 investment and not be satisfied with the 150 lots that are available to be built on at any given point. Why would you want to come in and take away beautiful greens to destroy the animals, the lifestyle of those things that live there? But what I want to point out to you is something, an anomaly that happened down at the Grand Reserve Golf Course, and I know I have 55 seconds. The Grand Reserve Golf Course of 2009, and I met the Armando Martinez through Mayor Holland back then. Mr. Martinez, when he hired me to be their director of solid waste, took me for a ride through the golf course and said, Perry, this is going to double the city size to 400 homes. We were all excited. That was great. And, of course, we had the crash. When the crash was over, we quickly ran into a problem. No building. Then it became purchased by another bank and built again. And guess what? It's now 800 homes. The folks that have the homes like mine are now completely decimated. Get $300,000, $350,000 house is worth $275,000. And there's 800 homes going to be built. Just a point. It's going to change the dynamic of what a house costs.
Thank you. Next speaker.
How you doing? My name is John McAvoy. I don't have a prepared statement other than I moved to the area of South Florida, Broward County. In 1981, and much of Broward County looked just like Palm Coast. I moved here 3 years ago because the builders basically packed it so full of homes, the quality of the life went down. The areas where you had broke up the areas in between the homes, forested areas, things like that, they disappeared. And the quality of life went down. So now I'm seeing here somebody that is going to attempt to do the very same thing that happened there. And I can tell you from experience, 1981 till 2017, I saw it all. And the plans to basically put a high concentration of homes and things like that and very small lots will not benefit this city. It will benefit one person, the contractor. And that's it.
Thank you for comments. Next speaker.
Excuse me, John Brady, Palm Coast. Two questions, and I'd like them answered. The apartments, the 280 or 380 on the same side as the theater, there was a sign there that said senior or over 55. That sign has changed. What changed? Why is it not senior? The second question is, how could you, as a body, approve the three-story buildings without elevators? Is this part of a fitness challenge? How is this happening? What were you thinking? Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, love it. Next speaker.
Good morning, Council, Mayor, ladies and gentlemen. Norbert Neilbach, Palm Coast. What everybody's talking about leads back to the last record I've been playing the last 5-6 meetings. Now you have a city traffic manager, yet you're continuing to use outdated facts to put homes in Palm Coast. You are going to have a traffic nightmare if you only use one vehicle per home, which is not the national average. Last year you created 2,000 plus vehicles here. So far, you're approving on US 1 between Matanzas and Whiteview, not counting single family homes, over 2,000 cars. And you're looking to cool more and more and more with Town Center and other places. Where are these cars gonna go at 9 o'clock in the morning? At 5 o'clock at night? You're gonna have backups. You already have them now. Easy one is Palm Coast, westbound from Town Center. Down the road, it's gonna get worse. You're looking to do work on resurfacing, I see today. That money could be used not for resurfacing, but maybe to ease traffic. But we don't know what traffic is. We haven't had a traffic manager here for quite a while. And now that you have one, he hasn't really had much of a chance to look at what it is. But same time, we're continuing to work to grow, build without any actual traffic studies. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, speaker. Seeing none, I'll close public comment. Wish the first speaker remained here, who could have explained the process of quasi-judicial. So for those in the audience that still remain here that do want a response and do care about the process, I think, Mr. Reichman, you should explain the process.
Certainly, Mayor. Yeah, and I'm speaking to the council, but also to the folks that spoke about the specific items, not the generic or generalities, but there were certain comments that I believe were directed towards a potential anticipated request for development of property in the Kansas Wood specifically. I have made comments like this in prior meetings and want to say it again so that everyone understands that this process is a little different than when we're making the rules. It's not a legislative process. The courts have specifically, the Florida courts have specifically created a separate process. It's called a quasi-judicial process that applies whenever a landowner comes in and asks a local government to exercise their property rights. And what I mean by that is ask for what's called a development order. It can be a rezoning, it could be a variance, it could be a site plan, whatever. When that happens, local governments are required to follow this process. And specifically, this process requires these folks up here to consider all of the relevant facts at a specific time. And that time is at a noticed hearing, so that everybody who has an interest in the outcome of that request for the development will be there or have the opportunity to be there all at the same time. And these folks are required to consider the relevant facts that they hear at that hearing, and just at that hearing. The courts have specifically said they are not to speak about or listen to people or emails or communications or phone calls outside of that hearing. And the reason is because it's like a courtroom, it's quasi-judicial. The purpose is for everyone who has an interest in the outcome to know, to feel secure that the decision that ultimately comes out of that public hearing is based upon the facts, the testimony, the evidence, the photos that are presented at that hearing, so that people are confident and would have confidence that there was not a decision made prior to that hearing or based upon information received apart from that hearing, but rather is based upon what everyone has had the opportunity to hear, including these folks who are sitting like a jury. So that's why it's a difficult process, but again, I'm trying to explain to the public the purpose of that process is for the protection of the parties. The property owners, the folks that live in the community that will be affected by the development. So these folks, to a certain degree, these members of this council, have their hands tied by the due process requirements that have been imposed upon them by the Florida courts. And so you'll hear me say, like this morning, what I'm going to say is that because this is quasi-judicial, these folks need to wait and not take into consideration some of the things that they heard this morning. Those folks that spoke this morning need to come back if and when this comes to a public hearing and tell these folks what they said this morning so that at that time, everyone will be there and have the opportunity to hear everything that's relevant to that quasi-judicial decision.
Yeah, and let me just add, I mean, if and when, that's the point. We've not seen a single proposal about the golf course come before this governing body. Not a single proposal. We have heard proposals that were approved at a recent hearing about multifamily housing units that were approved in 2004. Many, many years ago before anybody on this council had even served. So I would just ask with respect to this particular golf course property proposal, I have not seen a single part of the proposal. Our staff has not sent us a single part of the proposal. They certainly read about it in the media as it was presented to them, but not to this governing body. So if and when it does come before this council, I appreciate, frankly, the passion and the commitment of the residents in this neighborhood for coming forward and voicing their concerns. I think that is so important and certainly matters to this body. And I like the fact and respect the fact of going door to door. I think we are a community that does take these issues very seriously. So. It is frustrating to sit up here and have certain accusations thrown at you when we have yet to see a single proposal come before us about anything because we can't, because we're not allowed by law. So that quasi-judicial hearing is a very serious process that we have to take extraordinarily seriously. So I would just ask for the members of the public that still have remained, not those that just wanted to come and take pictures of us sitting here as she spoke, but rather just please share this with your neighbors, please. I think that's really important. When we do, again, hear this proposal, if we do, I'm not even sure where we are in the process, that we will take all into consideration, including the people in the surrounding neighborhoods that it impacts. So please. Thank you.
And if I could add something there, it's been very frustrating for me, and I'm guessing for everybody else on the council, to not be able to respond. But as an attorney and someone who has made a large part of his career in real estate and land use matters, the reason for this law that ties our hands is to make sure, I think, that, well, all people involved, all interests involved have a fair hearing. But frankly, I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, the old back room, smoke-filled room practices of the years before the Sunshine Law and the Public Records Law, when citizens would show up at a hearing and the fix would be in. And I think that is still part of the perception among many people. And I think, again, I speak for everybody on the council, but I can only speak for myself. That is not the case. You know, we are not allowed anymore to listen to arguments or lobbying or pretty pictures from some land use, some landowner or some contractor or some would-be developer than we are to respond individually to the citizens who have, as the mayor has said, I think very valid concerns, but until we know what is being asked of us, there's really no way that we can fairly respond to you. But we also can't
be meeting in private and listening to the arguments and the inducements of whoever it is that's developing this proposal. So it has been very frustrating, and it bothers me to have citizens feel like we're ignoring them or we're not doing our jobs, when unfortunately that's exactly what we're trying to do and protect the process so that everyone that has an interest in this gets a fair shot at persuading us with their evidence, with their arguments at the time it does come before us.
If I may, I would just like to concur with what Councilmember Cuff said. I know you can only speak for yourself, but I am in complete concurrence with what you said, and I often get rebuked from citizens. They say, what other process works like that? And I say, have you never heard of a grand jury being locked in a hotel for weeks without being able to, you know, watch TV or read magazines? And that usually clicks home for them, that this is a legal process and we have to abide by the law. So thank you for elegantly saying that, and you as well, Mr. Mayor.
Mayor, if I may, Council, just to add to the record of what you said, just to be crystal clear for the community, we have not received an application from Matanzas Woods. I'll say it again. There is no application. We have nothing from the developer in terms of an application. So I know there's been a lot of comment and speculation. We don't have anything yet. So we're waiting to respond as well as a city. Just to be very clear, we don't have anything from.
The reason why the neighborhood meeting was required, again, goes back to process, to alert the neighbors, right, of an upcoming possible hearing.
Yes. So that's an optional process that very few jurisdictions require. Palm Coast requires that to start the dialogue. So if the developer has an idea for a project, we require them to go to the neighbors, to go to the community to start that dialogue process. That's, in fact, what started. But the city was not, we're not part of that process for a very good reason to keep that separation, which is also, I've been asked that question. We stay out of that. We're not endorsing a project at that point. It's communication only. And again, we've not received an application. This has never come back to the city yet.
But well, we can understand the despair of these people here that thinks that their property is going to be worthless now. And unfortunately,
no,
there's
sir,
nothing.
No, this is not that.
Unfortunately, there's not much we can do because we bind them by the law. We understand, and at the right time, right place, which will be here, please come all together, bring your facts, bring everything, and we'll analyze it. That's the only thing we could do legally, I think.
It is the only thing, and I think it's important for the mayor, for council, for the public to understand is we're not making the rules here. We're applying the rules. When I say the rules, I mean the standards in our land development code for any request for a development order. So again, the level of examination is not at 10,000 feet. It's closer to the ground level. So not all facts will be relevant. The facts that are relevant are those that are going to be determined by the standards in the Land Development Code for whatever application, if we receive an application, that we receive. And so we're at this point, we hear what you're saying, but we don't know what's relevant and what's not relevant because we haven't received a request yet. So it'd be totally inappropriate for anyone in this council to be trying to interpret what they hear of whether or not that applies or not. It's just too soon.
I think it's important that we keep sending that message because it has been rather frustrating. And there's been a lot of development proposals that have come in all at once. And so having a neighborhood meeting probably confused the issue even further, frankly, especially when you have a project called Matanzas West that has nothing to do with the golf course. And so I do think it's important that we continually converse with the residents that have come together in a sense of unity. And again, I do appreciate that moment in our city. I really do. So I don't want to neglect the fact that they are passionate and emotional and committed to having their voices heard. And there will be a very, very significant process if a proposal officially comes forward, whether it be before the planning board or two public hearings before this council, in a judicial capacity. So I think we've made that very clear.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate that conversation.
Thank you. So do I. Thank you. And as far as the other speakers, you know, I will take the photo from Ms. Piglusi. I've written down notes to do some research and some due diligence and your comments as well. as the other speakers as well. So appreciate it. We'll now move forward to agenda item number E1, is an ordinance establishing a process for the issuance of trespass warnings on public property. Mr. Rice, would you like to?
Be happy to, Mayor. Yes, this is an opportunity for the city to establish some constitutionally adequate procedural protections for trespass warnings. Trespass warnings are lawful efforts that are allowed under state law to protect and respond to a threat of public safety and protect the public welfare. This is not, trespass warnings have been in the state of Florida for a long, long time. They're issued by local governments and more importantly by police and by sheriffs, so that's not new. What we're doing here is simply creating a process, codifying a process that will provide for these protections, these procedural protections, notice and an opportunity to be heard. So you'll see in this draft regulation, there's a substantial portion about an appeal process. And I want to reiterate that these are sparingly used, and they are used to support and protect what has been recognized by the federal and state courts as a substantial public interest in discouraging unlawful activity and, importantly, in maintaining a safe and orderly environment for the operation of city work. And so what we're trying to do is balance. We're trying to balance that underlying objective of maintaining public safety in public places for the public and for the employees against the rights of those folks who may receive one of these trespass warnings. And so we're just codifying a process. And that's what this ordinance proposes to do, Mayor.
Okay. Council, do we have any discussion or comments on this particular agenda item?
How many people do we have currently trespassed?
Two.
Okay.
All of those sound like good things. Yeah, that sounds like a fair chart. We need to protect our people, right?
Well, yeah, it usually takes a lot for us to trespass someone.
Yeah.
It takes a lot. They really have to use and abuse, for what I understand. Okay. And we simply just not going to say, listen, you're a persona non grata, we don't want you here. I don't think that's the idea behind this.
This is basically for the people that actually creates a safety for our either property, employees, or customers that come here. So that's the whole idea.
Well, that has to be the basis for it. They can't legally be issued. A warning, trespass warning can't be issued unless there is a factual foundation, as the council member just indicated. That's what the state law requires.
And it's not, no one on this council has trespassed anyone. Let me just make that very clear. Again, this goes back to the fact that my understanding, the one in particular case, is a long-standing case that former city manager had made the determination was necessary for the safety of his staff, frankly, in this organization. So it had nothing to do with the mayor, had nothing to do with council. This process that you are proposing allows for a due diligence process when it's determined that's necessary.
And I think it's important, to your point, Mayor, to state that the appeal process is going to be very explicit. It'll be provided for in, you know, any trespass warning that's issued, if there is one in the future. And the individual who will make the final determination, if there's an appeal, will not be anyone on this council. It's going to be a special magistrate. It won't be anyone that is a city manager or a city manager designee or an employee. It'll be someone independent. And that's necessary constitutionally to make that separation. And that's what's provided for in this ordinance.
Who's going to have the authority to issue those warnings?
The ordinance speaks to that. And of course, it's going to be the two parties. One is the sheriff or the sheriff's deputies. Or it can be the city manager or his or her designee. And those will be the two public officials. And again, they're the ones that will make that decision based upon the facts and the application of the state statute. And then they'll, again, as I said before, in that trespass warning, it will explicitly provide that there is an opportunity to challenge the issuance of that trespass warning.
And that will be done out of courts.
Excuse me?
That will be done in the courts.
Be done in front of a special magistrate.
I have not, unfortunately, had time to do any of my own research on this, but how does the proposed ordinance square with other jurisdictions in Florida?
It is comparable to, if not identical to.
Yeah.
the other jurisdictions that have done this, and it is consistent with the federal and state case law that is not applicable specifically to trespass warnings in this situation. But there was some issues, there were some cases dealing with the homeless, and there were some trespass warnings associated with that. And this has been also discussed with and worked with the Sheriff's Department. Their input has been received.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. My other question is this retroactive? In other words, does the appeal right, the magistrate, special magistrate we're referring to, apply to the outstanding trespass?
Yes, it will. Absolutely.
If they decide to use that right.
It has to be.
I mean, frankly, the way the world is going, as everybody says, sometimes scares me to death. But I think depriving anyone of their right to access public facilities or access the staff or their elected officials is a serious matter. And I'm glad to hear we've only had two instances before where we felt that this was necessary. Balancing public safety, and again, I don't want to sound like a hero because it worries me and it worries my family when citizens get agitated and words get heated, but my concern is also for the public. I mean, I've never been here in City Hall when the building was open or at any other city facility where there weren't members of the general public there going about their business, and the idea that we wouldn't put top priority on their safety so that when they come to City Hall or the pool or the community center or Holland Park is a huge concern to me. So I think balancing the rights of an individual who maybe has said some unfortunate things or consumed too much alcohol or controlled substance or whatever, and hopefully regrets that in the light of day is fine, as long as we are sure the sheriff is comfortable with the process we follow is doing what we can do to allow us to get on with the business of providing service to the residents and the businesses and the other folks who come to our city.
That's why we have warnings, I guess.
It's a very delicate situation. I mean, businesses have to deal with this, and certainly there's no business on the planet that wants to exclude somebody that comes to them and hopes they spend money there. I mean, we're in a different situation, though. Where you have to take First Amendment rights and due process and so forth into consideration with everything we do. So, I think the ordinance is a good step in the right direction, and if it allows us to revisit any of the outstanding issues we've had, or at least provides us with a clear direction going forward, I'm happy to hear we only have two of these situations. I'm frankly a little surprised we only have two.
I think that shows how sparingly and how reluctantly the city staff, former city manager, current city manager, sheriff's department have been to exercise this existing right with the balancing in mind.
Yeah. And, not to get off the subject, but I know the sheriff's department's been commended for their ability to diffuse potentially violent situations without using force. And I think that always has to be the preferred path. This is a small component of that. We're not talking about a brawl in the street or something here, but we need to be sensitive to it. But at the same time, telling somebody they can never come on city property again is a serious thing, and it needs to be done only when there really isn't any other alternative to keep the public safe.
Yes, sir.
I also think, going back to that, it is important that this council, it goes back to the due process, remains removed from this. I mean, it's one thing when someone makes a threat directly at one of us, which has happened to me, as a public official, but it's vastly different when you're talking about protecting employees of an organization. And I do think, We have a form of government for a reason, and the day-to-day operation is run by, you know, our city manager, and I think that needs to be respected. This gives another process at play to have an independent judicial hearing officer hear all the evidence and then come to a determination on what's best.
Yes, ma'am.
It's almost like without this ordinance, there's no direction to come back or how to come back in good graces. You're kind of like exiled, you know, and at least this way, these folks, these two, they have a course that they can follow, and it's in writing. So this is good.
Okay. Thank you. We'll move to agenda item number E2. Is another ordinance. I'm assuming, Mr. Reichen, you'll be presenting this?
Happy to.
Okay.
Okay. Again, this is, I guess, the best place to start with regard to this is an ordinance that is proposing for this council to consider placing some additional restrictions on the use and sale of and possession of what we all commonly refer to as vaping. I think it's important to start out with a statement that you don't see in our code regulation of smoking tobacco, because that is preempted to the state of Florida. However, that
is something preempted to the state.
Yes, I only point that out to make the second point, and that is that explicitly we are not preempted. Any local government, including the city of Palm Coast, is not preempted in regulating vaping, because it's not considered, tobacco. It's not considered the smoking of tobacco. There's a state statute right on point. So,
what is it considered? I'm curious. I mean, I don't know.
All I can tell you is, from the state of Florida standpoint, it's not considered smoking, which would be preempted. So, it is not considered smoking of a tobacco product. Not because it's not a tobacco product, but the manner in which the tobacco product is consumed is not considered to be smoking. With all due respect, to say that it probably is a matter of parsing the words and maybe policies versus common sense. But regardless, the net effect is that we have the ability to step in if this council so wishes and believes it's necessary to regulate in the area of vaping. And this ordinance does several things. Number one, it prohibits the sale to minors, being anyone under 21 years of age. Secondly, it is going to eliminate the ability of local governments, of establishments to exhibit or try to market or sell vaping products where there is not the requirement of an employee to be that third party. In other words, a minor or someone cannot just walk up and pick something up and then take it to the counter. It's going to be behind a counter, it's going to be behind a case, and that's going to how it will be merchandised. And then the third part of this regulation, this proposed regulation, is that vaping, the use of these devices, will be prohibited at all locations within Palm Coast where smoking is currently prohibited. So that is a third element. And again, these are opportunities that we just didn't make up. These are the types of regulations that other local governments in the state of Florida have already enacted. And I think it's important to recognize, and probably some of you have heard it, that the legislature, there's a Senate bill pending at this time that will step in, not to preempt, but to do some of the same things that are being proposed in this ordinance, specifically to prohibit the sale of vaping merchandise to anyone under 21 years of age.
I have a couple questions. Again, not very familiar with the vaping industry. Obviously, we've all read reports of the dangers of some of the chemicals that are handmade items? I'm not sure. Are these distributed by a manufacturer? How does this work?
Yeah. Well, Juul is one of them. Okay. J-U-U-L.
Those look like the USB sticks,
yeah.
Right?
Right. These things, of course, what the kids are doing is they're heating them up. If there's an LED type of, or a element, heating element, that you, and when they get it to the maximum heat, then it creates some toxic gases that liquefy itself and covers the lungs.
So it's not necessarily the product, it's how they're utilized.
It's how they're used, but if they didn't have the product, then they couldn't get into that situation. And the other thing, too, you'll probably see some restaurants will say that you can't vape in a restaurant. You know, that when this thing, this phenomenon first started, everybody said, well, I'm not smoking, I'm just vaping, you know. Nonsense, you know, because it's nicotine in the form of a liquid state that's heated, and you're still getting that addiction from that drug, nicotine. And, you know, the federal government just passed a law, and they raised the age to 21, so we're in congruence with that. But the other part of this is they didn't go far enough, because there are certain flavors of these vaping materials that the kids crave. And I did some work with the principals, actually with the superintendent's office, and then sub to the schools, and in the middle school, these kids are starting to vape there. So the numbers are starting to increase. That's why I felt that we had to really come down on this thing and say, hey, you know, I mean, under 21, no, we're not going to sell this to you.
And right now, it's anyone can go and buy it?
Yeah, there's no...
And what do our laws apply? What is the state law about smoking in Florida? I'm not aware of that. Is it not many parks? I'm not...
21.
Is it just 20?
Age of 21,
it's not
I believe that's...
on where you can...
Yeah, and there's a, you know, in certain municipalities, they don't want you to smoke in any outdoor parks.
Okay.
You know, local municipalities tend to restrict this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and of course, even in some restaurants outside, they don't want you smoking
mm-hmm.
either.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Like, if any restaurant that serves food you cannot smoke as well. Yeah, no, I mean, actually, I favor this approach, and I think it's a great idea.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like within our county, we're going to take the lead on this,
mm-hmm.
and I hope that the other cities mm-hmm. will copy our ordinance, you know, so that it gives them a base. But it's time, because this thing is like the flu. It starts growing and growing and growing, and then it's really a major health issue.
I do have a few questions. Quite a few questions. We just heard that within the legislation, within the next 2 months, that's going to come up. And instead of doing it right now, my opinion only, we should wait to see what they have and then increase if we need what they have. Because if they have a state law, okay, it's going to save us in a few other things, which is, who's going to enforce it? Remember, we're going to need personnel to enforce it. We're going to need at least, because we are already short in personnel, code enforcement officers. The best way to stop these things, sales to minors, these things, after sting operation, that's the only way you're going to do it. And who's going to do that? Apparently, we have already identified the need, was the way you're talking, which I believe you. You already gathered some from out there. And these are questions that I'm posing. What stops the kids from going 0 miles once we create that? To go to Bunnell or to go to Flagler Beach? 0 miles, they could get it over there. And I'm only saying this because the state is about to come up with something that will take the spending, for example, out of it. I'm a firm believer that this will be for the safety of the kids. Nobody is trying to do something that's no good for the kids. Okay, let's keep that in mind. But there are people, like I said, the state, like tobacco. Who regulates the tobacco? It's the state, a lot of us. They do sting operations. They come to certain places, and they lock people up, actually. Okay. And my question is, who's going to enforce it? If we're going to create a law, then we're not going to be able to enforce it. It's spinning wheels. Or are we not willing to spend the money to enforce it? Because once again, like I said, the only way basically you want to stop this, it's doing sting operations. And that, are we talking about also about the paraphernalia that goes with this, Mr. Reichman? The paraphernalia that goes with it, it's also in that...
Yes, that's part of it.
So they can't sell paraphernalia?
They can't. Any part, the materials that go with it, it'd be prohibited. Anything associated with vaping under the age of 21.
So I think, though, if I may correct, because I think as far as the enforcement goes, if we are requiring the stores to keep it behind the counter, that's what we do with certain items that are required to do it. So as a store owner, it's no different for them now just having to move it behind the counter, that the new law applies. So I don't see that necessarily as code enforcement. I don't know about the stings that they're going on around smoking, but I don't think that frankly Commissioner or Councilmember Howell's intent on this conversation was more about let's just keep it in line with 21 with the smoking. So I don't necessarily think he wants a full attack against those that maybe are in middle school, and I'm hoping that the schools do education about the dangers of this product. But I think it's more of just because it's probably an archaic law. I don't think people probably had vaping when they raised the age limit to smoking at 21, that they probably now are considering it to keep current with now this new device that's being utilized. So for me, I think it's just keeping that line. And I would say anytime we can get ahead of legislation and not just waiting for Tallahassee to determine what's best for us is a good thing. And I think that having this conversation, knowing that kids are utilizing this and kids maybe are utilizing it to a dangerous point that is not safe, I think is part of our responsibility as well to help us make our city safe. And you're absolutely correct. If they're going to Bunnell, they're going to Bunnell. Hopefully, if we take the lead, there could be some unified ordinance created and adopted. And I think we can do that.
And that was my point.
And I agree with you. The only thing I'm saying is this. You're going to have one in 2 months from the state.
Maybe.
Maybe.
We never know.
True. But all I'm saying is this. Are we going to do one that we're going to have to redo after the state comes out?
No, that's
what I'm saying. Okay. If we're not going to do it, are we so sure that we're going to keep ours the same way, or we're going to have to change it? Because the state sometimes, you know, that the state may do certain things, and we obey. We usually obey by the state. Well, if the state says X, Y, and Z, we have to obey. So we're talking about 2 months. Nobody is against this. I don't think anybody is against this. The only things that are parts that we should, because the minute we don't make this, we don't have to enforce it. The state will enforce it. And if the state enforces it, it saves us money. Once we come up with this, we got to enforce it. Because if we're going to create an ordinance just for the heck of it, I don't think we should. No. I think we should create an ordinance and enforce it because kids are important. But if in 2 months you're going to have somebody else with a lot more power than us to enforce it, I think it's 2 months, even though one kid that could go down.
Let me just correct the record. Any type of legislation that's created in Tallahassee that requires an enforcement, we pay for.
Oh, we do?
Yes. They don't. I mean, it's sad, but it's...
Same thing with tobacco, with the cigarettes?
Literally, it's all enforced locally. Now, they can tell us whatever they want to tell us, and we have to adopt it. However, the cost is incumbent. It's the same thing with school security, right? Okay. So the shooting happened in Parkland. The state legislators came together, said, how do we protect our schools? Let's harden the schools. They didn't apply funding to it. They did for 1 year, but the funding went away. So the cost is assumed by the local government. So I do think enforcement-wise, even if the state passes legislation, which I'm assuming you're wanting to make consistent with the proposed legislation, Mr. Reichman, is that correct?
When we prepared this ordinance, we were looking at comparable ordinances throughout the network from local governments. It was just recently, within the last week to 10 days, that the bill came out. The bill, which is a Senate bill out of by Senator Simmons out of the Orlando area, where it corresponds completely with this proposed ordinance, is the prohibition against selling vaping, any vaping products under 21. But I wanted to say also there's a couple of other things that it does that are a little different than what's in this order. I think that's a very good question. I need to say that. The bill also extends the prohibition against smoking within 1,000 feet of a school. So now it applies, you can't vape within 1,000 feet of a school all day, not just certain school days, school hours. And it bans all tobacco products.
Okay, let me just interrupt, because then that passes, we have to enforce it locally. So just understand that. So it's even additional layers if this does pass. I know Representative Simmons, well, I'm sure it probably has a very good chance if it's gone a week ago into this, which is okay. But just understand, again, if it's the school district now saying within that 1,000 feet, the school district is now incumbent or local law enforcement to enforce that.
And it also, now the state bill, just to make sure the record is clear about what similarities or differences, it also bans tobacco products, including vaping products within vending machines in areas where people under 21 are allowed. So that's a little different than what we're requiring. I think arguably we're
they sell those in vending machines?
Are they selling it now? I don't know. I'm assuming that if this is in there, that must be part of the problem.
Yeah, they are.
And lastly, what they're doing is it'll require customers purchasing tobacco products online to sign for the package and show a photo ID. That's not necessarily something. But it's different than, it's additional to what we've got in here. What we're trying to do is primarily deal with the direct impacts, or at least that's what this ordinance is tailored to. Again, anyone under 21 that is going to require for these vending machines or whether it's placed to that's going to change. It has to have with the intervention of assistance of the retailer or the retailer's owner or agent or employee. So it's like you just said, you know, that's behind in a case.
We don't have code enforcement right now going out and enforcing underage smoking. Like, that's not what our code directors do. So I don't see us now assuming that cost because this ordinance is adopted. I think it's really just, for me, my opinion is it's bringing up current an ordinance, a law, that will align with the same as smoking products, so tobacco products. This is a tobacco product. It's just utilized in a different way. So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Morton, are our code enforcement directors going out and enforcing 18-year-olds that are smoking? What is the smoking age?
Not smoking, buying it. That's two different things.
Well, listen, the buying of it, again, it's just necessarily in the back of the store is where it has to be. Now, if that store owner is now allowing for that, that's a different issue entirely. But our code enforcement is not involved at that time either. I mean,
I think we're not proactive. I'm not aware that we're proactively.
Are we creating a law that we're not going to enforce?
But the question I would respond back to that with is, if we're not enforcing it, what happens if even one person just follows the new law that we're setting? Then that's a plus in my mind. If we have to go out and enforce 100% of these stores that do this, then all of a sudden that becomes a problem. But if we even make this motion and one store puts this behind their counter, and even if everyone else is still in violation, and just for instance that we didn't go out there and enforce it, I think to everyone's point here is that it's still a net positive, because you know that one location is now just a little bit harder, and it might prevent an underage person from, I mean, literally potentially becoming bound to nicotine dependency for the rest of their life, and that's, you know, a real problem. So I grew up with my dad smoking like a chimney, so I've always stayed away from it, but I understand like how quickly that you can fall down that slope. And I mean, I just say it from the perspective of if we help one person, that's a net positive.
I agree with you completely. my thing was that, first of all, I did not know, and thank you for informing me, that we do not have to we pay for it no matter what. If we create a law, state law in this case, we have to pay for it to be engaged,
enforced.
Yes, enforced. And let's say we have someone that goes there and calls, connect my friends. Mr. Joe is selling this behind the counter.
So we're going to have to go enforce it. That's what's going to be. So, and that was my only point.
And that could be done.
Reactive. I mean, that's reactive.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to be able to be proactive on this.
Absolutely. Well, the proactive part comes on the fact that the city has an ordinance.
Yeah.
Parents will be aware of this. Store owners will be aware of this. And if we get consistent complaints that a store owner is not abiding by our ordinance, then I think it would be appropriate for code enforcement to go over and say, hey, you know, what's going on here? You know, we've got several complaints of you people here doing this and that, and it's in violation of our ordinance. Now, we can do a couple of things. Best of all is to cease and desist. And then if it continues to be a problem, then, you know, then we'll take the appropriate legal action.
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, when I know that the council previous to us took on the internet gambling?
Internet cafe, that's what
internet
they refer
cafes,
to.
Where the slot machines, you know, I know that they had adopted an ordinance. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
And then, so that would absolutely, you know, if someone called and said they're operating an illegal practice here, I do know that they were sent out to shut it down. So you're absolutely correct. There will be an element of it, but I don't necessarily see us sending an army out and saying we're going to cease all vaping, you know, under 21 tomorrow.
This will curtail them. I don't know if you remember, maybe not here, but remember when the kids were smelling the glue?
Yeah.
Remember when it was the sprays and all of that? What they did in certain stores today, up to today, there are certain places where the sprays are still behind. So those things curtail them, don't get me wrong. And they work.
Yeah.
They work on this aspect. They work because families become aware of it.
Yeah.
Kids become aware of it, and the kids tend to be afraid sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay. And if that's something
true.
That's going to
instill fear in them, then all
so
good.
Yeah.
My only thing was this,
yeah.
And that was my only two things
yeah,
made. It was who's
yeah.
going to enforce it, and are we going to be in contradiction in any way, shape, or form with the one that's coming up in 2 months? Maybe
yeah.
in 2 months, we should just, not only my opinion, we should just listen to what they have to say and then work around it. If we have to change something, do it at the time, then doing it now, and then doing it later.
Bill, right?
That's that was my way.
You have the draft bill on that one.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's.
Yeah.
I think it's important. Councilmember Howell was saying, you know, we have the draft bill, but I mean, draft bill is the beginning of the session. It's only gone through one committee. And from the report that I read, there were already some suggestions about the changes that were being made. I did want to comment from a standpoint of practicality on enforcement. If you look at the three things that this ordinance is trying to do, this proposed ordinance, obviously it's going to be a little bit more difficult for when you have someone that may be violating this ordinance and selling to someone on a situational aspect that's under 21. That's going to be tougher to enforce. But when what would be easier to enforce is if someone is selling these items you know, not behind the counter. That, I think, from a standpoint of, to the extent that local government wants to get involved in the active or proactive or reactive enforcement, that will be something to be easier. But I did want to say this. Right now, as I understand it, this way it's been described to me, is that if this passes the legislature, one of the big hammers, one of the big tools, is that it will equate the violations of this as a violation of the selling of tobacco. And it's my understanding that in order to sell tobacco in the state of Florida, you have to have a state license for that. And if you violate the terms of that license, then the state can get involved and take away that license. Because this will be added to that and equated to the sale of tobacco, then if they violate, if it's passed by the state of Florida, the legislature, then they could then a business could lose their license to sell tobacco. So that would be a tool. And again, we'll just have to wait and see what happens in the next month or 2 months from that aspect. See, but we don't have the power to put in our code anything about the license because we don't issue the license. So it'll be interesting to see how maybe we can, local governments, let me say it that way, can work with the state legislature to try to address this concern.
Now, the other interesting thing, too, there's certain businesses that are national businesses that have removed the stuff totally from the store. There are some. I think Walmart is one. Some of the CVS and other places. They've already seen the handwriting on the wall. So you end up with some of these little convenience stores maybe selling some of the stuff. But, you know, I just think from my perspective that what the state will come eventually will parry right into, you know, we'll be all right with this ordinance. I don't see any conflict.
Well, the only thing that would happen is if there is something in the ultimate legislation that comes out of Tallahassee that would be in direct conflict with this. And I haven't seen that yet. Because there's express preemption.
Here's the deal. I hate sitting here having conversations on what will Tallahassee do, okay? Because we never know what Tallahassee is going to do.
Correct.
And it is a source of frustration for me because if we have a moment that we can help design and craft what's good for our community, then I don't want to sit here and go, what if? Tallahassee is like a wild, wild west, and by the end of session, only 14% of bills
Correct.
That are actually introduced at the beginning pass. Only
Correct.
14%. And those 14%, those bills are vastly different when they were first introduced.
Thank you.
That is exactly what happens. So if anything, we would amend the ordinance to be consistent with it.
Right.
That's all.
That's it.
Very clear, very easy. It's not complicated.
Ms. Mayor,
yes.
I have an emergency accident
yeah.
real quick. Could you just have the red reflect that I do? I'm sorry, but that
right.
isn't the
okay.
I just got the thing.
Okay.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you for bringing this up. Agenda item number 3 is a resolution approving a contract with Halifax Paving Inc. for the street resurfacing program.
Second to present.
Morning, Mayor and Council, Carl, Engineering, Stonewater Department. We have Mike Grunwald, our city chaplain engineer, today is actually going to make the presentation for this item.
Morning.
Morning.
Can you start me up, because I'm... Good morning. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to present to you about Palm Coast's possibly most visible asset, our city roads. Currently in Palm Coast, nearly every road that we have is paved in asphalt. While the resolution said we're here to talk about, well, the agenda item said we're here to talk about a resolution for funding. What this presentation, what I'm trying to do is give you some context. What are we doing? Where did this come from? Why? How did we get here to this point? So in my presentation, I want to have you come away with 5 messages. We have a 5-year program for maintaining our roadway. 2 of those 5 years are actually funded in the current fiscal 2020 budget. We are going to be accomplishing a number of objectives for the council, things that you have asked for in doing this project. There is a gap in the 5-year plan budget versus the funding we need to complete the 5-year program, and that needs to be considered as to do we need to change our objective or do we need to find how we're going to fund that. And then we have the resolution of the funding for this particular project, which is going to be the fiscal year 2019's plan, which was pushed forward in budgeting into the fiscal year 20 plan. So the council objectives, maintain a quality roadway network. I'm going to touch more on that later on in the presentation. The other objective was evaluate intersections. In putting the design together for the arterials, We evaluated all of the intersections that were within the project boundaries, looking at the radii of the intersections, were they adequate, and looking for tracking of vehicles across non-paved areas. Looking at consistent striping, where are the stop bars, where is the specific striping going, and we put together a plan that changes and modifies the striping that's currently out there on the roadway sections to a striping that's more consistent and gives the driver, in my opinion, a little bit better information than what you're currently getting from the roadway system. Another council objective is to modernize our traffic signal system. As we're going through this project of milling and resurfacing along our arterials, we're going through traffic signals. Each of our traffic signals in the city currently has detectors at them. The most common detector is an inductive loop detector, which is buried in the pavement. As the milling machine goes through, as it tears up the pavement, it's going to tear up those detectors. We have two different plans. One, where we have traffic signals that have mast arms. We're going to be replacing those detectors, those inductive loop detectors, with video vehicle detection instead of inductive loops. Where we have span wire, we're going to be replacing those detectors with a different detection pattern, possibly different, possibly the same depending on what was there, so that the final pattern that we put in for the detection is going to give us the best solution for that intersection. So the question that might come up is, are we shortchanging those intersections that have span wire by putting in inductive loops as opposed to putting in these new video vehicle detection cameras? And my opinion is no. Inductive loops are still considered by most traffic engineers to be the gold standard in traffic signal detectors. The video vehicle detection is going to, we've had very good success with the particular brand that we're specifying. Not all video vehicle detection equipment in the industry is the same. The product that we're going to be putting in is the Terrace camera, and our maintenance team has reported very good success with these cameras, that they perform equivalently to an inductive loop for the detection. The advantage that we get from the cameras is we can bring that picture back to our office, and if we get reports that there are problems with detection, we can view the detector that is the camera, view that picture at the same time as we can view the detector pattern that we've programmed out there to operate, and see whether there is a failure occurring where we're not getting detection when we've got vehicles going through, and we can see that in real time from the office and make changes from the office to the detection pattern to fit what's currently going on with traffic. The not so silent next wave in the world of traffic is the autonomous vehicle. So council has directed the engineering team, look forward, find out what's going on in the world of autonomous vehicles. What should we, the city of Palm Coast, be doing with our roadway network right now so that we are there and prepared when the autonomous vehicle becomes a reality and it hits everybody's streets? We've done a lot of background information. It's really been fortuitous timing in that I've received quite a bit of information from the DOT. They're publishing a lot to the traffic community about what's going on in the autonomous vehicle world. I'm going to be giving the council a report later in the year after I've gathered all the information and put it together for a summary for you. Right now, for our maintenance program, key item that is the summary of what should be doing for autonomous vehicles is clear and consistent roadway striping and highest visibility possible of the roadway striping. This is a picture of our 5-year plan. On the left, in the odd years for the fiscal years, listed as starting fiscal year 2019, in green shows the segments we have for the fiscal year plan for arterials. On the right, fiscal year 2020 is also in green, showing what we have planned for doing residential work.
This chart shows essentially what we've got in the planning concept for our silo, separating out by fiscal years, arterial, then residential work, then arterial, then residential work. Reason for separating it out rather than doing some arterial and some residential the same year is that arterial milling and resurfacing is a different animal than residential. How they differ. The arterial work is going to be nighttime work. The residential work is going to be done during the day. The arterial work runs through traffic signals, so we have issues with traffic signals there. Typically, the residential will not. The arterial work is going to have a significant striping plan and design. The residential work typically will not have much striping being done on those projects. The arterial work is going to, I have one more item in there. I'm going to skip that one because I just lost it. Apologize for that. But the arterial work and residential work, you can see from the graph, from the chart on the side, that the number of lane miles that we'll be able to accomplish is going to be significantly more during the years that we do residential work. And the intent is, if we can take these packages and give a single contract type, expect that with economies of scale, we're going to get better pricing from our contractors than if we gave out two smaller projects that had different operation types. So,
let me ask this then. So, has there been a cost-benefit analysis included in this process? You talk about economies of scale, of a cost savings of doing more miles per year as to not go out every few months to different roadways and sort of parcel it out. Has that been conducted?
There hasn't been a cost analysis comparison. But your second piece of your question that you asked, the going out to separate parcels, pieces of parcels, I'm not sure, I'm not clear as to what you're asking.
So go back to the map that you had about different roadways. Go before that.
Okay.
So you're looking at pavement of work by year, correct?
Yes.
And so are you looking at how many different road miles per year, or how many different projects per year, or how many different, meaning, is there a thought that if you do more of these road miles in sequence within that year of connectivity, does it allow for cost savings because you're not having to now go back out to a new bid and everything else? Has that been done? Matt, do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, and the theory is, Carl can speak to the level of analysis, but by compartmentalizing the projects, what we're trying to do is avoid two things that generally increase significantly project costs as a rule of thumb. So on those specific bid alternative analysis we have, that's probably the most accurate way to gauge that, is when we divide projects in different types, say residential or commercial, there's different applications of equipment, spray trucks, painting, different, you know, that comes with a large cost of mobilization as we move those pieces and start projects around the city. And then again, usually you'll get that type of contractor that will hire that type of, you know, crew that's experienced in that work, as contractors will do when they're in their wage scale. And so the theory is by consolidating a residential type and keeping it as compact as we can to reduce the remobilization and the re-disruption, and then compartmentalizing the commercial work, again, the delta there is commercial, the arterials will be done at night, which is a different contract variant, versus residential arterial streets can be done in the day. That naturally creates a different price element as well. So if you want to speak more in depth to that, to the rationale.
And part of putting the plan together, we had Transmap do the pavement condition index and analyze all the roads, and then we put some logic to it. You can see where we group colors together. We look at the residential road, there's pockets of blue. So they're not doing one street in that section and coming back 2 years later to do the other street. So we kind of grouped them together and made that remobilization and tried to hit multiple areas in the city, but a group of roads at the same time.
So the first way to answer your question, Mayor, is Carl and the group put a lot of expenditure relevance in our bidding knowledge to try to obtain the best price. There was not a qualitative analysis done to secure that price level. We've used the experience we've gained as a city to say, hey, these are the parameters that we know a night work or a double closure or lengthening times will increase that contract price. That was the logic Carl's referring to.
The chart showing the miles, basically, that you're proposing for each year, is the residential pavement maintenance linear miles or lane miles?
In both of these numbers, we're looking at lane miles.
Okay, because so, I thought the map referred to linear miles.
Yes, unfortunately, we had a duplication there where we were going in one direction one time and one direction the other, whether to report in linear miles versus lane miles, and weren't able to adjust the map to lane miles in order to make
just
it
to try to get a feel for what the scope of the project then is. But I mean, for clarity, because I'm dumb. A residential street is a half a mile of linear street is a mile of lane miles.
Typically, that would be true.
I mean, it's a two-lane road, so right. You're saying you're doing a lane mile, what you really mean is you're paving a half a mile of linear pavement.
Correct. And then, by contrast, on that same concept, Belterre Parkway, where you've got four lanes and you've got turn lanes, and each time you add additional pavement to that, you've reduced your linear miles by consuming lane miles.
And just a more general question, going back to the priorities, you said that for the residential maintenance, whatever we're talking about here, the cost doesn't include any significant budget item for striping. I know typically what I think of as our residential neighborhood streets don't have striping. However, in light of the citizens' concerns about speeding and people that can't tell whether they're in the right lane because of the typical paving width of a residential street or neighborhood street, have we looked at, and I know somebody's going to say it's a bucket of paint and a guy to put it down, and I understand that's not the case. We looked at some striping costs earlier or last year, but has there been any budget analysis to beginning a uniform striping system for the neighborhood streets or the residential streets at the time of this type of maintenance?
One of the things that I haven't started it that long ago with the city, it was only about 7 months ago, and when I first came in, I was trying to get a handle on just that question. What is our city's standard for an arterial road, for a connector road, for a residential road? And the feedback that I got was somewhat soft, and it's, you know, we really don't have a clear, we don't really have a history of having it defined. So it's kind of been done on a this person thinks it should be done like this person that way. And for myself, I've kind of come upon a theme where our arterial roads are going to be striped with the reflective markers. For our residential roads, we're going to go with no striping, stop bars at stop signs where we need arterials, and striping to accent striping in the center line. The reason I've looked at that is because I can't see a cost justification for putting the additional striping down on the roadway. And once you've crossed that line of we're going to put it here, then it becomes a question of, okay, to be consistent, where do we put it?
I do think, to council member Kopp's point, I mean, it's a valid point. You know, just because we've done it one way, or maybe not have done it one way historically, doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at other ways now. And so, you know, when we're talking about public safety, that is a priority for this council. So I do think that we need to integrate those conversations when we're talking about the possibility of analyzing where we are now, where we're going with the actual plan, that logic should also be applied. If there's a moment in time where we can say this would add to the public safety in residential neighborhoods, at least that should be brought to us as a decision point to say, if we are going to go in that direction, then we need to understand the increased costs and what that's going to mean to the overall budget.
There is, the TPO has a study that kind of in a holding pattern, they're looking at funding to do, it was part of the Safe Routes to School with the Flagler School District, and they were going to look at optional striping as to how they would stripe to deal with walkers, especially walkers, you know, to go to the schools. And so that may help give us some feedback on what their recommendations will be. We've worked with them and put together a scope to begin that project, but they're just waiting for funding to move forward with that study. Then, but that may not hit all the interim residential roads. It's probably going to be more on the, I guess you could say, the collectors.
Yeah, I guess my point, not being a traffic expert or an engineer, is if it's been studied and if the conclusion is that it ain't worth it, I mean, in the sense of it costs way more than whatever incremental, arguably incremental safety gain you make. I mean, that's a decision ultimately, it seems to me, that the council has to make, but only after being informed by our, you know, by our experts on the subject. I'm not saying we need to stripe every street, because I know we've never done it, but if we're getting complaints from citizens about speeding and about cars that can't, I mean, some of the streets, the radius of the turns in neighborhoods is pretty tight, based on the way they were laid out, I guess, by modern standards. I mean, I know there are places I drive where I hug the right-hand side because I know there isn't a lot of room if I'm passing another vehicle, particularly a truck or a larger, big SUV. But I guess my question was, have we ever really analyzed whether striping on the residential streets would improve on that situation or whether it's just wasting money on something that wouldn't make any difference. I mean, that's really all I'm asking. I'm not saying we need to stripe everything. But.
And your question is exactly a perfectly valid question, because I am not aware of any documentation which would show you a benefit for that striping. And then you're into the now the logical argument. Does it seem like it would be, or does it seem like it wouldn't be? But I have, to my knowledge, no way to quantify what value, if any, we're going to be getting back from that striping. And then once we've put striping on our roadway, what are we actually telling the driver who's driving it, someone who's not familiar? To me, if the road has no striping, I'm telling you, this is a residential road. If it has striping on it, I'm telling you, this is an arterial or collector road that you can expect to drive
fast. Let me just say, in your mind, probably not in most residents' minds. I do not drive on a road and go, this is an arterial because it has striping. That's never been my thought. Now I may think that way since you've now opened that into my thought process, but I can assure you that the majority of our residents aren't driving on residential to go, this is residential, this is signal because there's no striping. I think because you're in this industry, it probably is something that, you know, you're familiar with. So let's try not to make that assumption and tie it to a signal of what residents would think. I don't think that's what our residents think.
Yeah, in my experience after driving the neighborhood streets here for 37 years, what residents think is, if it's straight enough for long enough, I can exceed the speed limit by 20 miles an hour. If it's curvy, I have to slow down, but I drive out in the center of the road to avoid clipping a mailbox or something like that. And I guess my question was, first of all, are there studies that show whether certain types of striping in those situations either slow vehicles down or help them negotiate? There's a mailbox on my street that has been knocked down, no exaggeration, 15 times.
How many times did you knock it down, Bob?
Well, I haven't, not yet, but, you know, and it's, I understand how it happens because it's on a radius, on a curve, but, again, I don't mean to get anecdotal, I'm just asking, are there industry studies that could guide us as to whether it would be worth the cost? And also, because I keep thinking, because that's one of my little hobby horses, and you mentioned that a lot of the proposed autonomous vehicle technology works a whole lot better on streets that have clearly defined center lines as well as edge striping, is my understanding. I mean, there are vehicle assist, the driver assist systems in place now that will keep the car between the stripes if it's turned on, as long as the striping is clear enough and the speed is within the limit. So, I'm not saying we got to stripe all 500 linear miles of Palm Coast roads to those standards. I'm just, you know, we're already worrying about a funding hole in our pavement management program for years after 2020. But I think that's something we need to be thinking about and need to be looking at as we go forward, as much for public safety and as much for being prepared for new technology as, you know, hey, you stripe their street, we want you to stripe ours. You know, I mean, we would have to prioritize it. I doubt we have the money to be able to stripe every street in Palm Coast.
We are, you know, we will be going out to bid for residential roads in February, and so we'll do a little analysis, see what we can dig up on information, and if we find it could be fruitful to pursue it, we could bid as an alternate with the bid, right? So we know the real cost. We'll have some recommendations, see what kind of information we can dig up on that.
But I do think prioritizing. I mean, not every street is going to benefit, if at all, from it as much as other streets. It's just something I'd like to have some more information on. Set appropriate budgets and priorities.
Well, I agree, and so I think if the council agrees, we can add that as part of the option to look at what that cost differential would be.
Yeah. I'm also concerned, when going back to your modernization of traffic signals, I hope that you're staying in tune with the U.S. Department of Transportation. You know, the latest information that they have on their traffic condition manual for traffic control devices, so that when you're talking about different ways to trigger and you're upgrading, that everything is compliance with the DOT, to include the striping.
Yes.
You know, because that's going to nail us. Okay.
Okay, some background. Analyzing the roadway, which streets get handled first. The city of Palm Coast had the practice of sending out a city employee who would subjectively grade each of the roadways, and based on that employee's grading of the roadways, those are the roadways picked to pursue next. The city hired a company named Transmap to provide us a pavement condition index, pavement condition map. And with that, it gives us a scale for each of one of the roadways on a computer-generated rating of 0 to 100 of what that roadway condition is. So this is just a general scoring systems of what the grades from the PCI index, or pavement condition index, break down to. And as of 2019, based on projections, the average Palm Coast roadway PCI would be 79. That doesn't mean that every road is that, but on average, that's a scale of grade. This is a map that Transmap developed from us. On the left is the map from a high view, and on the right is an inset showing individual scoring of the roads that was done from the map that it was given us. And you can see how the individual scores there, the numbers that show up in red, they're just small bunches, and if you look, when you'll see the map again in the presentation, you'll see that we've stretched out and covered more than just one bad spot at a time. One of the things that Transmap did for us was that they answered a question. Given reasonably flat construction costs over the next 5 years and the city's active budget for roadway maintenance, what would be
the outcome if we followed our current budget for the overall PCI index? And second question, what would be the funding level we would need in order to maintain our PCI index as it currently is? And the my understanding is that the instruction from the council was maintain our pavement condition index as it currently is.
Well, that's what we could afford, basically. I mean, you're talking about what's in the budget today and the available monies for it. So I think we all aspire to be able to maintain more road per mile per year as we did when the half-cent sales tax was applied to it. So I don't remember us ever stating that we just needed to maintain it. Rather, a budget was presented, and this is what we could do each year. Is that correct?
Yeah,
that wasn't.
Have we looked at grants from the federal government to assist us? They're out there.
I know with DOT, the county gets some special funding for grants on some of the railroads, especially to convert dirt to asphalt. On some of our DOT projects, we include resurfacing with the project, but I'm not aware. We will check with DOT, but I'm not aware of any specifically only for resurfacing of our local roads.
You sniff it out. If there's free money, I want it.
Okay, so comparing the two graphs, the green one showing what maintaining the pavement and its current PCI index, and the red one showing our current budget projections for maintaining the roadway. This shows what the shortfall difference between those two graphs is in terms of how much money you get from one graph line to the other. Currently in the 2020, we have $5.5 million budgeted, which was going to cover both the fiscal year 19 and the fiscal year 20 operations that are shown in the previous map. So this is the map again, and what I wanted to just reiterate was that we're trying to meet and accomplish council objectives with this program. This program is based on the higher level of funding. If this is not what we can afford, we just can't do this, then we'll need that feedback from council so we can come up with a plan that fits a budget that we are able to get. But currently this plan is based on going for that ideal target of maintaining the PCI index throughout the city.
So we are about 10 million short for the next 5 years, 10.3.
Yeah. Yeah, so on an average rate of about 2 million a year.
So those costs go up every year as well.
Yeah, we built some cost increase into it slightly, but they do vary. Asphalt can vary greatly depending on the year.
Budget number or the projection. Shortfall, Carl, is based on.
It's based on a previous funding.
The level of, but it's based on the desired level of maintenance that's shown in the previous chart.
Right.
So, in theory, I'm not saying I would ever want to vote for this if we were willing to tolerate a gradual deterioration in the pavement and the city overall. You can play with that number. I'm not saying we want to, but it's that number is based on keeping things essentially as they are.
Right, fairly high level, right?
Yeah.
If we wanted to let it slip a little bit, you could reduce that funding.
Well, I just, I mean, I don't know that that's what anybody wants to do, but I just, not upgrading anything. It's just keeping it at that level. Okay.
Okay, so the city has put out a construction contract for the fiscal year 19 plan that was presented to you. There were three bidders on the contract. The low bidder was Halifax Paving. And what we're asking is, would the council please consider approving these funding amounts The top number is the contract amount that Halifax Paving bid. They were the low bidder. The second amount is a construction contingency fund to cover unexpected overruns and items that come up during construction that have to be addressed that weren't part of the design. And the third item on the slide here is a funding amount to cover construction engineering inspection by a consultant on a time and materials basis, and then not to exceed $100,000.
Is this coming out of our sales tax?
This comes out of Streets Improvement Fund.
Which is funded by?
I think it's partially by the state gas tax, I believe.
Yes, it is the state gas tax and a portion of the state revenue share.
So it's basically out of people fueling up here locally, correct?
Yes.
That's
definitely.
Why we have to think. We have to think definitely. That way. Yes. Okay, Council, any questions or comments?
That's the end of the presentation. Are there any questions I may address? Good.
Thank you. There are no written items as of today, so we'll move to agenda item number G is public participation. For those that have not spoken at the beginning of the meeting, have the option to speak at the end. You have up to 3 minutes, and your time will start.
Nobody left.
Closed public comment. Okay, we'll move to discussion by City Council of matters not on the agenda. Councilmember Hell.
I do have an answer for Mr. Brady with regards to the elevator deal. Mm-hmm. Because when Mr. Douglas and Mr. Cimento were here, they were talking about the project last January, I'd asked that question. You know, and they said that the elevators were strictly for the fourth story building, which is in the back, which is basically going to be for seniors. And then staff did some research because I'd asked them, well, what about the three story building? So the younger people are there, they're lazy. They're not going to be going up there, you know. So I have fun trying to rent those places out. But staff found that there is no requirement. State requirement that they have to have elevators beyond the second story. Mm-hmm. So that's what we found. That's all I got.
Good.
Nothing for this meeting.
As to the city, really don't have anything else to say. I just want to send my sympathies to the family of Kobe. Mm-hmm. The families that died on that helicopter accident, and let's keep them on our prayers. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I have nothing at this time. Discussion by City Attorney of matters not on the agenda. Discussion by City Manager of matters not on the agenda.
Yes. Thank you, Mayor. City Council has promised and was inquired a while back, bringing back an analysis and conversation around the proposal of possibly eliminating one workshop a month. The premise for eliminating one workshop a month was really twofold. We've had a series of long workshops with light agendas, and I did do a summary of those to show, you know, the average length is about 87 minutes, 82 minutes, excuse me, for those workshops. And it began to feel, at least from my perspective, that the council's showing up to serve the agenda rather than the agenda serving the council and our community. So by way of an analysis from June of last year, of all the workshops, it found that by more than a ratio of 2-1, items submitted were written. So you guys are used to disposing of and inquiring, researching written items on those agendas. So adding those items doesn't necessarily extend the length of the workshop. So transferring those written items are not extending lengths of workshops. Again, we found that workshop lasted about 82 minutes or so, or just over an hour. Further looking into that, if we take out the Pledge of Allegiance, the adoption of city minutes, the comments by council, the comments by staff, and the city attorney, we eliminate somewhere between 14 and 20 minutes of each meeting, so we're duplicating those times. We did have a very long workshop on January 14th, but that stemmed from a series of canceled business meetings and workshops all in a row. So we had three or four workshops and meetings, if you recall, over the holidays canceled, and we didn't have the SAP presentation. So that one meeting really was a one-off. We know those will come in the future. We know those are going to be long. We know that that's a lunchtime meeting when we're dealing with SAP or a very big council priority. So presently, we hold workshops on the second and last Tuesday of every month. However, there is no contemplations of workshops. Workshops were instituted back in 2007 by former city administration. It's not a charter issue, and it's not a council procedure or policy issue. So in essence, what that means is it is council's or direction or guidance on their need to meet to transact the city business. What the charter does say is council meets at least once a month, which we do. We meet four times a month presently. There are two options. There is a recommendation just looking at workflow from times to get to business meetings to night meetings and back. But our opinion is giving the staff, is the conclusion we came at, looking at the times and looking at the scenario from a information processing, from an agenda management, from a, again, from staff's perspective, holding no less than one workshop a month and agreeing on a generally agreed upon schedule for that, which, again, looking at pragmatic workflow, and there's two options, obviously, could either be the first workshop or the second, would be first Tuesday business meeting, would be remain consistent, second Tuesday workshop would continue to be your workshop, and then the third Tuesday business meeting. So we have a cycle of workshop, business meeting to keep that workflow together for the community, for the council, to keep it consistent. There are some issues, of course, that we recognize, staff recognizes, that make all this work together. One of them is our job as staff being very clear and consistent on our written items, that you can rely on those, that we're answering questions up front, that we're doing our due diligence, that we're going to make sure we're evaluating those items through our framework, our strategies, and really trying to communicate what we're accomplishing. Council's confidence in consent agenda items. Council has relied on consent agenda when your items have gone through workshop and or in first hearing and are ready to move to consent. Staff will always be aware, as council, by your direction, that written items will be submitted, but always that reticence that if we need to have presentations, that availability is still there, as we did today, to cover, to ask questions, to get feedback, to make sure we're still on track with a project and the direction of our council and community, and that there will always be the availability of holding a second workshop as necessary. Candidly, that very well may be an issue later in the year when we come to budget. There's a lot of work typically to do. But we, again, did do that analysis. Again, from a workflow perspective and a time savings on the production side, on the workflow in the background, again, all the minutes, the agenda, all those items, it would significantly free up a lot of staff time and help us be more consistent with managing that workflow. I don't see a massive time loss. Again, this is based off some of the analysis, which will bear itself out in practice, by removing one workshop per month. And I know I was asking.
Really, really,
Dr.
D.
Sorry.
I was like, wow. You have me at one workshop.
Right? Oh, sorry.
I actually say this with all sincerity. I appreciate your time because I do think it's important that when we conduct the business of the city by this body, that we are being transparent, we're being open, we are open government, and we're having enough time to contemplate the serious decisions that are required by us. So I have watched us have workshops just to have workshops where there are maybe one item or two items on the agenda, and we have staff sitting in the back of the room, and which requires some of them to travel over here and be here and sit. And I think having the one makes a lot of sense, and maybe for a period of time, if you feel as an administrator that we're not really conducting the business that we need to, and we're seeing an increased level of different agenda items, I think that would be preferable for you to also communicate that with us. But I am in favor of moving it to one workshop a month. And as budget time comes, I'm sure that will change, just due to the fact that we have a lot of approvals that we go through. So, and as you stated, we can always add another one or have one announced if you feel that it's time-sensitive items that need to be addressed. Does anyone else have any input?
I'm certainly in favor of trying a new schedule. My biggest concern with varying from our current schedule is we already get criticism and comments about things that are being passed and nobody knows what's going on, primarily on the consent agenda. And, you know, that's, we spend millions of dollars of the city's budget every business month, every business meeting, but very frequently at our business meetings by moving the consent agenda, maybe pulling one item to talk about it, maybe not. So I am a little concerned about our ability to meet as a body, given the constraints of the Sunshine Law, to get input from, you know, my fellow council members. I mean, I'm not trying to butter anybody up, but I really do care to hear what the rest of the council has to say on issues. And sometimes it isn't, you know, the vaping ordinance or trespass warnings like today that are sort of, you know, but sometimes it's some item that we're purchasing. And, you know, I mean, yes, the staff backup is normally very thorough to the point that it can make reading the backup impenetrable sometimes, and that may be something we can work on. But at the same time, I don't want to go to a bunch of, you know, five little happy, feel-good PowerPoint slides that are summarizing a, you know, a $2 million agenda, you know, item from our budget, and just look and say, okay, well, the staff's in favor of it, this looks good, nothing to see here, and then have it, you know, pass without any discussion. If council has, you know, if somebody on the council has a concern, but I guess that's our job to bring that up if we do. So, I mean, I'm willing to give it a try. I just, I don't like meeting for the sake of meeting, but the number of times when we are convened as the city council and the citizens have access to us are few enough. I mean, sure, I get buttonholed in Publix and Walmart and at the restaurant and everything else, like I'm sure we all do. But that's a very different kind of interaction than when we're all here and we can all hear somebody address us, or we can all address each other with what we think are important priorities. So I think we need to kind of keep an eye on things if we go to the one workshop and make sure that even if we're getting the public business done more efficiently, it isn't, you know, at the expense of deliberating on things that we do need to think. You know, maybe we need to think a little harder about the budget item here today on road maintenance is a good one. You know, we're already in the hole, and maybe we need to be spending more, not less, but it's kind of hard to reach a consensus on that if, you know, a contract for paving is a consent agenda item, then all of our priorities for the most part are given to staff in one-on-one meetings because of the requirements of the Sunshine Law during the SAP process. So I let's give it a try and see how it goes. But those are my concerns, and I didn't feel like approving that as a consent agenda item, you know, and having everybody wonder what happened in the discussion.
Okay.
I'm good. I was going to go to three instead of one. Just,
I don't appreciate it.
1 month. That 1 week.
Take our direction, and I have one last item. Just because I'd be remiss. It's good news. So we've been tracking. It's really good news. It's amazing. I was actually having a conversation with a resident of a neighboring city. I won't mention the city. Not in Flagler County, I will say that. And they said they put a request in to their local government, and they hadn't heard anything for 3 weeks. And They're just amazed at what we're doing as far as citizen engagement, how we value our residents' feedback, and our ability to perform for our residents. And so I got the latest update this morning. You heard about field service lightning. It's 2 weeks old, roughly. In that time, we've received 179 calls for wastewater response. So you call the city, so I need help with a wastewater issue. We can prove that our response time is not 3 weeks, not 3 days, 2.7 hours, less than 3 hours on average. We are getting to you. We are addressing your issue, and then you're getting that follow-up email from us that the work was completed. So that is, to me, a phenomenal statistic. And then I was going to also mention, I think I'm number one. Am I number one, Stephanie? Was that the first one? I have the new QR code on my pep tank sticker, and created a test case. And when those go out, we're asking people, feel free to create a test case so you know how it works. Put test in that headline so we know you don't really have a problem, but getting you familiar that when you have that PEP issue, you're not worried, you're not concerned, what do I do? I went out last night, and it was actually nighttime. I wanted to see if it worked in the dark, and my iPhone picked up right away the QR code and opened up the window in my phone, so it's great. So I put my own sticker on, but I think staff is putting stickers on for people and making them aware. But just, I can't say enough again as a manager, to be able to know how our staff is performing, and not just anecdotally, but to see it, and then we're getting to our residents in under 3 hours. I'm very proud of the utility staff, very proud of the platform that we're able to see this, to really affect great customer service, which, again, I'll say it again, we're making the people a priority and a purpose, not a distraction of what we do here at the city. So thank you for supporting this initiative and allowing us to continue to do great things with it.
Good.
Yeah, following up, I mean, I think that QR code for the PEP tank thing is a wonderful idea. As far as informing the public, I don't like to patronize anybody by suggesting they don't know what a QR code is or what it does. I'm sure most of our households in the community have a smartphone that is capable of, you know, creating the work, but I mean, what are we doing with the utility, with customer service, to, you know, inform people about this? To, again, you know, I'm impressed with Palm Coast Connect's adoption rate and the number of people that seem comfortable using it. But the PEP system is sort of a special little sub community, and
Not so little.
I was going to put words in Cynthia's mouth.
That's
I have to. She'll tell you exactly.
That's a good point.
The training and education we're going to do.
Actually, a good example, home show. We actually had a booth at home show, and between Friday and Saturday, we signed up 58 people. So we are trying to get out in the community. Every new customer coming in, we're asking if they have a PEP tank and giving them the QR code. On the QR code, it also has a link. So if you want to go on your computer to do it, and then also our telephone number. I mean, our call center is still available anytime. So
we also have the ability to push information out. So we can geofence the actual PEP tank areas in the community, and we can push that communication to our residents by email.
Yep, we actually do it with Florida Park Drive. We have an event coming up, and we were able to geocode Florida Park Drive on the residents and input all the email addresses we had and push the notification. We only have 19, but we're pushing out to get more and more, so the geo point is working tremendous for us. So we're going to push out more notifications as far as, we just got them in yesterday, so now it's like, all right, let's, you know, the manufacturer's going to put them on as they're building the PEP tank. Every time the service guy goes out there, they're going to put a sticker on there, and then as they walk in the door, we're going to try to educate the customer on their new QR codes now.
Was the geofencing been affecting the Palm Coast population of geocows?
Geo turtles.
Sorry.
Oh my God.
Okay.
I'll make a motion.